All right, it is time for another episode of the Fifth Estate. This is actually episode 100. I'm Jay Caruso, deputy editor of Washington Examiner Magazine, along with my co-host Ben Howe from How Creative. Get it? Ben, is there? Oh, wait.
Just get that when I told you the other day?
No, you the funny thing is that you made it sound like you just, like, thought of it that way.
No.
That's the way you said it. You were like, how creative, right?
Well, the problem is there was no URL for howcreative.com available, so I had to get How Creative Group. So that people always hear, you know, How Creative Group, it doesn't do the same thing. But when I say How Creative, they're like, oh, that's pretty creative. Gotcha. You know, I have to hire you now.
All right. Well, and coming in from Madagascar is the news gal, Andrea Ruth, who's the associate editor at Arc Digital and also a co-host of the Right Side podcast. Hello.
Hey.
There she is. Hi. Got that connection going. Hmm. All right. Our guest tonight, we're excited to have her. I was telling her that she enjoys the distinction of being on the 100th episode of The Fifth Estate. She was also the final guest that we had before this podcast went on hiatus for a year. She has her own podcast, which you should listen to. We'll make sure we have that in the show notes, called The Roth Effect. Carol Roth is here.
I am here. And guys, congratulations on episode 100. That is tremendous.
Well, you should only congratulate Jay. I've only been here for like 10 of them.
Well, you can still take credit. Still the 100th episode, so you can still take credit for that.
Yeah, you're that's still
America, isn't it? That. Yeah. I'm going to start
tweeting about that. About the audience that I helped build over 100 episodes.
All right, so we invited Carol here. For those who don't know, Carol is a free market advocate. And when we talk about free markets, we're not necessarily talking about, you know, straight up, you know, laissez-faire capitalism, but free markets, which is I'll let her explain what she sees as the difference between the two, because I've seen her on Twitter kind of saying, hey, you know, just because something is private doesn't necessarily it's a free market. So there's a lots of different ways to go about that. But what we wanted to do, and we'll have some general conversation, but what we want to do is we're going to ask Carol about certain issues. You know, of course, as the 2020 election comes up, candidates are advocating certain types of policies that I am certain that Carol is opposed to, in terms of, because they're not part of the free market. But that's not all. It's not just Democrats. You have a lot of, you know, Trump friendly Republicans who are talking about breaking up, you know, big tech companies. And so we want to see what she has to say about that. So that that sounds good, right, Carol?
It doesn't. I just have to say I'm opposed to everything. So that's just to put that foundation out there. Pretty much, if there's an idea out there, good chance I'm opposed to it.
Okay.
I'm all about that. I'm all about that life.
I miss the glasses half full. So
okay. Mm-hmm. So there goes any chance that you'll have of being on Shark Tank, because you know, it's one of those. You're like, nope, don't like it. Nope, get out.
To be fair, I was a judge on a Mark Burnett reality show, a competition show, America's Greatest Makers on TBS, I was nicer than people expected.
Oh, so you there were some ideas that you liked?
There were. I gave some good encouragement and feedback. I mean, the nice thing was I didn't have to put my money in. We were giving away $1 million and it didn't come out of my pocket, so I could be a little bit more generous.
Ah, there you go.
Came out of my pocket. You know, sort of the socialist version of Shark Tank, so to speak. I had that going for me.
Oh, that's cool. Okay, so let's start off with kind of an easy one here. You know, and there's different variations, ideas coming from Democrats about college, paying for college. And so, you know, there's ideas from Elizabeth Warren about debt-free, but there are also people like Bernie Sanders who is advocating for, quote-unquote, free college. So I'm somebody who is a younger person who is kind of enamored by Bernie Sanders, and I say to you, well, what's wrong with free college? Why is that a bad idea?
Well, first of all, free college isn't free. It may be free to you, at least for the current time, but somebody has to pay for it. So then the question is, if somebody has to pay for it, who is that person? And when young people say the government, the government doesn't have any money. They don't produce any money. They don't produce any goods or services that create money. They take money from nice people like you and me. So that means that you and I are the ones who are paying for this third party's quote unquote free college. And when they get to be a taxpayer, then they're going to have to pay for other people's free college, which that in and of itself may seem okay. Well, you pay for mine when I can't pay for it, I'll pay for yours later. The challenge, the rub, so to speak, is that it distorts the demand for college. Basically, the fact that you don't have to worry about paying for it, that somebody else is paying for it, means that you are more likely to take advantage of. It's kind of like if you and your friends are all going out to dinner and you're splitting the check evenly, you might order an extra steak and some wine versus if you're paying for yourself, you might order the spaghetti. So people get very generous when they don't have that direct accountability. And that's what's happened with college costs thus far. The government has gotten involved. They have provided loans. Those loans aren't based on anything. They're not based on your GPA. They're not based on your major. They're not assessed in the way that somebody would assess any other loan that you might take out, a mortgage or a small business loan. It's just you exist and you want to go to college. And so we will be happy to give you your loan. And so that has distorted the demand for college. There have not been a lot of new colleges that have come online. And so that has increased, by the laws of supply and demand, the price of college. And the college has no skin in the game. They don't care. They're getting paid either way. The government's the one that's on the hook. So they're like, this is great. And that's why even during the recession, you saw when everything else, the price of everything was tanking, prices of college, just continuing to go up. And it has gone up at some exponential rate of the rate of inflation, the rate of everything else. And the reality is the cost of college at this point for many degrees and at many institutions is really higher than anything you could ever get a return on.
Yeah, I was reading something about, the origins of college loans, and they talked about how in the late 40s, even the early 50s, you could go to Yale for about $500 a year is what tuition was at Yale University, as opposed to, it's like you can find the smallest of state colleges still going to cost you thousands.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like $1940 to $500 in 1940s dollars versus today. That's still pretty expensive.
It's expensive, but even with the rate of inflation, I think it was something like $8,000 or $9,000 a year for Yale, as opposed to what it costs now is probably what, $50,000 a year to go to Yale.
Probably somewhere in that neighborhood.
But it is. What you said, and you talked about somebody was complaining about college debt, and I said, follow the trail, kind of, go back. When did you start to see college tuition increase at absurd rates? Right around the same time the government started providing loans to anybody who would apply.
Who would have thought of that? It's amazing to think that there would be a correlation there. Absolutely shocking.
And so this is the thing that
gets me about all of these types of, whether you're talking about student loans or you're talking about all levels of cronyism, with the auto industry and TARP and all of these ways that the government gets involved in things, when they come in to do like a big bailout, which is kind of what they're talking about here, when they're talking about doing free college for everyone, it's the same mentality as a bailout. Everything's gotten out of control. Let's just pay for it. And one of the problems is always that there's been decades of doing it wrong to begin with. And the government is already so tied up in it that when it comes to presenting a free market solution, it's often treated as unrealistic because of how messed up everything already is. I mean, with healthcare, it was that way. I don't and didn't support Obamacare. But I do think the reason that the healthcare system was in such disarray and was so expensive was because of government meddling. So when you've got decades of government meddling already, how do you back out of it and make it something better?
Well, I think the first thing is you need to explain to people the root of the problem. The fact that people have a lot of debt does not mean that we need to make it free. It means that we have to make college more affordable, and trying to get people to understand this chain that if college was affordable, you would be able to either, you know, work your way through or take on a small amount of debt and pay it off. And that, you know, that's the issue. That is not fun. That is not sexy. That does not sell well in a political ad. That is not something apparently that a lot of people can understand, based on many of my conversations on Twitter and the fact that we are even in this situation to begin with. So it's very difficult. You're asking me, how do you get politicians to do the right thing? And that is the $22 trillion and counting question right now. How do you change politicians' behaviors? How do you get them to say, you know what, we're just going to get out of the way? Because then it's like, well, that means that I might not be able to get a loan, or I might get a smaller loan for my gender studies class, or, you know, you hate women, or whatever the trope is, because people don't actually want to solve the problems. They just want to make themselves feel better. So I wish I had a real clean answer on how do you fix government without blowing the whole thing up, but not sure that we've got enough time to handle that one.
Yeah, it just seems like we have to suffer. I mean, like, that the only way to get things to be better is to suffer. Because this is even, you know, beyond college. It's so many different levels of everyday life. I have a friend who's an attorney, and he's a bankruptcy attorney, and he kept not... He was very unavailable. He was very busy. And I asked, oh, wow, I guess you're getting a lot of business these days. And he said, well, it's April, and it's always busy in April. And I said, well, why is it always busy in April? He said, because that's when people get their tax refunds, and they use their tax refunds. They blow a bunch of it. They save $1,000 of it to pay a bankruptcy lawyer so that they can file bankruptcy and all the crap they just bought. And he said, so it's a very busy time of year. And once he explained everything to me, I realized how many careers were dependent on this system that needed to, you know, these bankruptcy lawyers are making money off their clients, and the judge and the clerks and everybody involved in that sense. So many people were involved in making their livelihoods were dependent on people filing bankruptcy a lot. And it scares me when I think about trying to fix these problems, because I agree with you with everything you're saying. And I generally treat any regulation or any meddling by the government as a super bad idea. I just grow concerned when it comes to figuring out how we back out of it. Is it just going to, it feels like it has to be 20 years of education and suffering.
Yeah, well, it's definitely education. I mean, one of the things that, you know, the bottom line on all of this is that we have a very poorly informed group of people who are living in our country. And even though I spend a literal fortune every year in property taxes funding the education system, financial literacy and economic literacy, which are, you know, foundational things that you would think everybody should need to know in their life, somehow don't come into the curriculum, probably to keep people from the government toll. But that's a different discussion. But, you know, we definitely need to continue with the education. And the reality is we need to elect better people to office. And this is the challenge. So how do you elect people who are principled enough to do things to basically vote themselves out of a job? And that's, you know, that's the challenge, you know. And, you know, obviously there are people on the other side that are really good at, you know, finding people to run and, you know, amass power. But, you know, going back to one of my favorite economists, Milton Friedman, where you're going to find these angels to organize society for us, you know, even temporarily, how do you find the Justice League of politicians to go in there and just tear the place apart and get this stuff through and say, you know what, this is hard, but we're going to have to do it.
Mm-hmm. Right. So one of the things that you mentioned when you were first talking about this was the idea that one idea is to base, you know, what the government is going to loan people for school, kind of look at what they're going to study. It's like you said, if you walked into a bank and you applied for a loan, a personal loan, and they said, well, what are you using this for? And you say, well, I'm consolidating some debts. Okay, if your credit's good enough, you probably get the loan. If you walked in there and said, I'm taking it to the track, you know, I'm going to spend it betting on horses. Chances are you're not going to get it. So I was looking at, while you guys were talking, I was looking at like Indiana University. So Indiana University has a school of computing and engineering, and it also has a school of gender studies. Now, in-state tuition is $10,400. Out-of-state is $34,000 if you want to go to Indiana, if you live in Illinois. So it's expensive. Right.
Let's take that. Let's say you get that done in 4 years and you're out of state. So you're Illinois, you're going to Indiana to study gender studies. You're going to pay $120,000 for a gender studies degree. How are you possibly ever paying that back?
Right.
Get a high paying job writing about gender at the Daily Beast.
Get a job in the school administrating on diversity and inclusion.
That's right.
But it's the guy getting the computing and engineering degree who's probably doing something that's making good money, and he's actually, I hate to sit there and say gender studies don't contribute anything.
The engineering guy, if right. you're going to make $120,000 coming out and you're going to take on $120,000 in debt, yep, fine, go ahead.
Right, and so, I mean, that would be a... That sounds like one of those common sense solutions that would say, but then again, you'd get to the point where then who decides what gets X money and what doesn't? And, you know,
and that's why we're in this position to begin with, right? So if you think about why, what used to happen, what's happening now. So it used to be that the banks were involved in this. And, you know, they, I don't think, had as strict of criteria. They, you know, they were told they had to do certain things, but at least they had, I think, you know, a little bit more of a risk profile. But, you know, there is this constant charge. The reason why we are even talking about paying for education or loaning money for education, because, oh, some so-and-so came from a disadvantaged background. Should they be denied the opportunity to go to school? Somebody wants to study this because they think it's important. Shouldn't they be able to do it? And, you know, you've got all of these kind of touchy-feely emotional arguments that come into the mix, which is why we're doing this. I mean, the reality of the situation, the best possible solution is that this is entirely markets-based. But that means, again, that you know, some people who, quote-unquote, didn't get a fair shake aren't going to get a fair shake and are going to have to go figure out some other way to do something, which, by the way, isn't an awful thing. You can make a ton of money not going to college. You could go be a plumber right now. There's such a demand. You could go make $85,000 you know, your first year starting out without having a college degree. So there are plenty of things you can do, but it doesn't fit the narrative nicely. And that's why we're in this situation to begin with. But I mean, the ideal situation is that the government gets out of the business and either kicks it back to the bank and, or even better, makes the colleges have to sign or co-sign for part of this. Because if they have the risk involved, that's what is going to make the determinations more appropriate. That's what's going to bring down the cost of education. That's when people are going to go, yeah, I don't think that's going to happen. Or, you know, if you're going to charge me this, I'm not going to go study gender studies here. Maybe I'll do it at the community college. You know, if you want to study gender studies, go do it someplace where it costs you $3,000 a year instead of $34,000 a year. Doesn't mean you can't do it. It just means that if you're looking at this as an investment and you're expecting to pay it back, there needs to be that return on investment calculation.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about, let's move it to something different. And I was talking about earlier about conservatives. We see a lot of conservatives talking about this, especially the Trump conservatives. And not even, it's not so much the Trump conservatives or the Trump supporters. The one of the co-founders of Facebook originally called for breaking up Facebook. And you hear about people, you know, with Alex Jones getting kicked off Facebook and Twitter, and Paul Joseph Watson getting kicked off Facebook. There's been this call now for, believe it or not, from generally people who voted Republican all their lives, now saying that they want the government to regulate tech companies to a point where it makes it more difficult for them to boot people off their platform. And so what do you have to say about that?
Oy vey. Okay, so first of all, the whole, let's unpack these in chunks. So the first of all, like, let's break up Facebook or any of these companies. I don't like this company So we should break it up. Like, what does that even mean? I mean, if you think about Facebook, and by the way, I should disclose, I am a Facebook shareholder, not anything meaningful that's going to change my life, but just from a stock disclosure standpoint. So I'm a Facebook shareholder and a Google shareholder and probably a bunch of other tech company shareholders. So,
well, yeah, I mean, if you invest your 401k in a tech fund, chances are you probably own some.
I have to do this.
Twitter people be like,
about Facebook.
Yeah.
Facebook owns Facebook. They own Instagram. They own WhatsApp. They own Oculus, which is a VR headset company, and a bunch of other random stuff. So if you break up the company into these other companies, so they now have to divest Oculus, or they now have to divest Instagram. How does that solve your problem? It doesn't. It's stupid. It's petty. It's a ridiculous discussion. And, oh, by the way, it's not what antitrust is about. Antitrust says there is no competition, and therefore the consumer is paying more, and so we're trying to address that. Facebook is free. And, oh, by the way, Facebook is not that important to your life. You can live without being on Facebook. So the whole discussion around that is ludicrous, not to mention the fact that you start getting into government regulation. And have you seen the people who are in a government? Really? You think you want them regulating tech companies? Like, they couldn't find their way out of a paper bag. So that seems like a really bad idea. Now, that being said, what's really cool and what people don't seem to realize is that us as individual users or consumers have a lot of power. And if we make enough noise and are obnoxious enough about it, the companies tend to change their policies because they don't like the bad media. They don't want to lose a bunch of customers. And so you vote with your dollars, or if the platform is free, you vote with your time, or you become that squeaky wheel and you can affect change. So there are ways to solve problems without running to the government, which is the basic thesis of my life and foundation, that there's always a better and more effective solution. I am somebody who is pretty close to a free speech absolutist. I believe that people have the right to be jerks. And is this a swearing podcast? Can I let things fly?
Go for it.
Okay, so be jerks and assholes. Like, if you want to be an asshole, I'd rather know that you're an asshole. I'd rather use my speech to combat your points. And, I want to know about that. And I'd rather have that out in the open than have all these people be deplatformed who are outsiders and potentially harboring weird thoughts, who all then go into the dark corners of the dark web and concoct and do whatever. So unless you're actually calling for violence or breaking the law, in which case I think those particular posts should be shut down, or if you're using it for terrorism, you're removed from the platform. But if you're just expressing your really crappy thoughts, again, who's to decide what's crappy on what day? So I'm in favor of, if you don't like it, use the mute button, use the block button, don't pay attention to it, use your speech to combat it, do whatever you want, but stop whining and just let it be on the platform. And I think if more people took that slant, I actually don't think it would be that big of a deal anymore. It's the picking and the choosing and the hypocrisy of the, we're targeting these people, but we're not targeting these people. We think that this is right and we think this is wrong. That's what's causing all the drama. If all these tech companies got together and says, guys, stop being babies. If you don't like it, move on. We would be done with this issue in a couple of months. It would be gone. And then people would just, continue on their merry way. And so I think that is the best way to address it. I do think it's a bad thing and it's dangerous for people to be deplatformed from social media, and some of them are losing bank account access, et cetera. But I believe in market competition, and if the companies don't get their acts together, somebody will come up with a better solution. Doesn't happen overnight, but it happens over time.
Right, it will happen.
What's amazing to me is, a lot of these conservatives that supposedly believed in free market values, not only are they asking for these regulations or for breaking up the companies or any of the other things they're talking about at the government level to solve this, they're not doing the most basic free market thing that there is, which is to leave. Like, they've got this whole beef. And when people ask me, they're like, they're going to do it to you next. The first thing I say is, first of all, no, they're not. Like, I'm not doing anything. And if they did, sure, I wouldn't be happy, but it's not the end of the world. I will live. And
honestly, we'd probably all be happier. I mean, if they kicked me off the platform, and not that I hope that they do, but really in my life, it would probably be a better thing.
Yeah, I think it could be a better thing for all of us. But they can't seem to admit they want to make it a public square debate and all this other stuff. Really, what it boils down to is they don't want to leave. Like, they don't want to leave. And then when
comfortable. It's the same thing with the, what's her face? I'm not going to name her name, but the three-letter crazy person, the little baby commie, not Bernie Sanders' old protege there, you know, shopping at Amazon for her campaign while, you know, running them out of the state because they're evil. Nobody wants to do the hard work. If it's bad, if you really want to show them, then, you know, put your money or your time or your account where your mouth is and show them. Otherwise, you know, whatever.
Well, that's, yeah, well, that's what Ben, well, Ben cracks me up.
They cite the fact that there's no instant solution. And, you know, when you say something like build a new one, they're like, oh, look, it's that easy. Who said it was easy? Who said it should be easy? Why should it be easy? These companies have invested billions of dollars into what they're doing, and you like it. And if you think that the way they're doing things is irresponsible or shouldn't be working that way, and you have to put in effort and it takes a long time, that's good. We should like barriers to entry. I mean,
exactly. I mean, think about it. I mean, MySpace used to be the big thing. Before there was Facebook, there were lots of people on MySpace, and people on MySpace thought that that was the be-all, end-all, and that was the only thing that would ever exist. And now, you know, those people all went to Facebook, and some of them went to Twitter. These things are not going to be the only thing forever. I mean, we've already seen, I mean, how fast did Snapchat fall out of favor with the young folk? You know, they ported over to Instagram and to TikTok. You know, people are fickle, and you know, there are some sticky elements. I mean, I've always said, if you really want, you want to blow up Twitter, you get the president to move to a different platform. That'll take down Twitter in about, you know, 3 weeks.
That'll work. Well, but I think what Ben was saying is interesting, because the people complaining the loudest about these liberal tech companies and complaining about being kicked, you know, their people getting kicked off and worried, they are the ones who have benefited most from these same platforms. Their brands are built on attracting a Twitter following of 175, 203, 400,000 people
who
buy their books, who read their articles, who watch their videos. I mean, that is where they've built their brand, and yet they still complain about the liberal tech companies trying to silence them.
They're smart enough probably to port their audience over. I wrote this article many years ago, probably almost 10 years ago now, and basically said on social, your audience isn't your audience. So, you know, get an email list and start moving it, collect those emails and start communicating directly with those people, because it's not your platform. You're just invited there, but it's not yours. You don't own it. You don't own anything.
Right.
So if you're going to base everything around that, you better have a good plan to, you know, connect with those people and get them ported over somewhere else that you actually own, or you don't have anything.
Well, and people inflate the importance of what they're doing on Twitter. Because, you know, when I was in high school, there was a shopping center called the Arboretum, because we had nothing to do, and everybody went there and just hung out in the parking lot. And at some point, the police got sick of it. They started kicking all of us out, and it was like a nightmare trying to figure out where we were going to go and what we were going to do. What a lot of these people really are upset about is they like that they have a blue check and can talk directly to Jake Tapper. I mean, like, this is like the quad in high school or something. It's where everybody goes to hang out. They just don't want to be left out. And they're acting like it's a, I get the idea of how it's dangerous. So when I say it's not a freedom of speech issue, I'm not diminishing what's happening. I understand that there is this bias, and I've seen it, and I've seen how it plays out.
Yeah, and it's horrible, and they shouldn't do it.
No, right. They shouldn't do it. And but the thing is, it's the conservatives that are yelling the loudest about this, that are ensuring that they can continue to do it, because they won't leave.
Right.
Or they won't organize. I mean, you know, obviously there's a way to organize enough pressure. You know, it's, which, by the way, isn't that difficult. So if it's really that important to you, there's a pretty clear way to organize some good pressure to get these folks to rethink things. You know, they're beholden. All of these companies are public. They're beholden to their shareholders. They've got boards of directors. They've got PR departments. They take those things pretty seriously. And, you know, because, of course, some of the people who were knocked off first were the goofy people, and nobody seems to, you know, care about that. You're not, you know, hearing the broad support that you should. But if you really believe, as you do, that it could happen to anyone, which it could, and it's not right in principle, and it's that important to you, then organize something, because they will pay attention to that.
What do you think about, like, the banking stuff, though? Do you think that there's some limits there in terms of, because I know that there have been, you know, banks that have stopped working with gun manufacturers, and, they, you know, like, is there, in your mind, is there room for regulation around what, where the banks can and cannot decide people aren't allowed to engage in commerce?
Well, it's interesting because there was a provision in the Patriot Act, which is sort of a know your customer provision, that actually does the opposite, that you kind of have to pay attention to who your customers are. And if you think they're involved in, let's say, terrorist activity or money laundering specifically, then you need to report that and cut them out. So it's actually, the regulation has pushed the banks more towards getting rid of the bad actors. Not that I am in any way trying to conflate a terrorist or a money launderer with, you know, goofy people on the internet, but that it's in that same spirit that they can say, oh, hate speech, what's a terrorist organization, what's a hate organization? Like, there's a pretty fuzzy line. And so the banking system, the regulations actually are pushing the opposite direction. And I think you'd have a really hard time because of the, you know, the ties to the Patriot Act and everything, you know, redoing that in the other direction. What I do think is that, again, it's a really good opportunity for somebody to step up and to be innovative and creative in terms of, you know, the solutions that they offer. And I think that there's going to be a big demand for, you know, privacy enabled or, you know, free speech enabled, you know, situations. But even then, you're still going to have to draw a line somewhere, because as much as I am a proponent of free speech, you know, I'm not going to be, you know, letting the jihadis on my financial platform. And so there always is going to be a line. And, you know, so that complicates things. But I do think it should be pretty straightforward, but everything that should be straightforward gets bastardized.
Yeah, well, David French of National Review said he'd like to see these tech companies establish what he called a First Amendment framework, not necessarily implement the same type of, you know, same type of thing that we have in the federal government in terms of the First Amendment, but a framework of the First Amendment that allows people to pretty much have free and unfettered access to these platforms and not have to be afraid to get kicked off, unless, of course, they're engaging in the kind of behavior you're talking about. If they're threatening violence, if they're planning terrorist attacks, you know, there's nothing, there's no protection there, and you can't complain about that. I don't like Alex Jones. I don't like Paul Joseph.
Actual calls of violence or breaking the law, I've written on this as well, that seems to be, you know, that's pretty clear delineation. And again, that doesn't mean you have to be removed from the platform either. That could just mean that those particular tweets are shut down. So there should be a framework, but I agree. It needs to be, like you said, that should be the adoption, and everybody gets to play. And then there also has to be some thought into time frames. You know, if you're a criminal and you get caught doing something bad and you go to jail, you pay your debts to society, you get a re-enter. Look at somebody like Milo Yiannopoulos, who's like in his 30s, who's just, you know, a little crazy, kind of funny. And, you know, he's been kicked off of like every platform. So does that mean like when he's 70 something years old, he still can't use Twitter? Like, is there any path to redemption for the Milos and the Laura Loomers and, you know, all these other people? Now until the end of time, is this an infinite thing? I mean, it just seems like they haven't been particularly thoughtful about that.
God help us if we're all still tweeting in our 70s.
Oh, jeez. Well, it's like, I don't.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm gonna hijack the podcast and go back to you guys. Do you think that we'll still be doing the social media thing, like, you know, 30, 40 years from now? Or what do you think happens?
The main reason I do is because I think we've always kind of done it. I mean, the moment that everything came online, everybody jumped on AOL, and the chat rooms basically function the way Twitter does now. Then everybody moved over to message boards in various places, and it was the same thing.
Same thing.
Then MySpace, then Facebook. I mean, it's... I've always thought of social media as an inevitability because it's really just what we always do. We get into a big room and we talk.
But here's
and, like,
the thing.
Twitter's a giant room.
The size of the room has exponentially increased, and that's, like, the weird thing to me because we were always in these tribes, and so we're a very tribal social people. You know, we connect. We have this need for connection, but there's always been some containment, like even on AOL chat, or if you were, you know, you had some sort of a hobby and you had an affinity chat board, there's always some size to the group you're talking to. Like in some of these, like in Twitter, even if you're only following X number of people or X number of people follow you, like random people from everywhere just start jumping into the conversation. And so the size of the room is completely unwieldy. So do you think that shrinks back down again?
That was the thing that I was going to kind of bring up as far as, like, if you even talk about church groups. Like I come from a, you know, church background of where 200 people in a church is basically what they consider the maximum. And then you've got small groups in larger churches. And it always seems to come back to people wanting a fairly small group of accountability partners, whether it's religious or just, you know, lifestyle wise. People want kind of smaller groups of people to be accountable to, whether it's on a personal or professional basis. And I think that people will kind of shrink down groups again. I don't think that there will be this free for all, especially when it comes to the fact that you can get, you know, your livelihood threatened being on Twitter. I know that I have, like, I'm not even talking about a livelihood issue. I'm just talking about a, like, interest overall and ability to have, you know, reasonable conversations on Twitter. I make one, you know, kind of like tongue-in-cheek joke and get, you know, just horrifying things, you know, said back to me. And it's like, I was saying a joke. And the fact that people, I think, crave small, intimate groupings of people. And I think that shows in historical connotations that we do kind of gear towards small groups rather than large mobs.
But I totally disagree. Like history shows that people freaking love mobs. And we've now ended up with a platform of nonstop mob access. And with the small groups, they do exist. Everybody I know is in like several different group chats or group DMs. Like we still have our small groups and we have our cliques and everything else, but people are addicted to mobs. They love them. This is like just every day you can go somewhere and pick up a torch and light somebody on fire. And it's always been this way. Back in the AOL days, I'll never forget this. I was like 16 years old and I was like, an angsty teen. And I went into one of those chat rooms. And this is like 1994 or 1993 or something. And I go into the chat room and I was having problems with my girlfriend. I said something about it in there. And the first reply I got was kill yourself. Okay. So like nothing's changed. I just think that people are dying to get in rooms to yell at each other, even if they still have their small groups.
Well, the one thing that I will say that people like about the bigger groups is, and not about the groups themselves, but I think with access is that there always may be that chance that you may get retweeted by somebody with like a million followers, you know, and you look at who retweeted me. All right, go ahead, Andrew.
It's like a drug.
Yeah.
No, but here's the thing, is Twitter expanding or contracting? There's still a relatively small amount of Americans that are like active on Twitter. I mean, you know, it's like when I sit there and say like I become more and more inactive on Twitter, like how many people, like, you know, both of my siblings, you know, who are also millennials, just don't interact on Twitter at all. They don't have, if they have Twitter accounts at all, I don't know about it. They're never on there. You know, it's same thing with Instagram.
But
like
it's a very small
amount of people in the first place.
It's a mistake though to think of it that way, because the media and Hollywood and academia and the political class, you know, prior to social media, they influenced everything. They influenced everyone. And what Twitter is a place where the media, the political class, academia, and Hollywood all get together in a room with their blue checks and argue with each other.
Well, that's so, why it's so gross.
Even if there's like less people on here, the problem is they are the people who are out influencing everyone. And so something that happens on Twitter, yeah, if I went to my neighbor right now, he'd have no idea what I was talking about. I could say, oh, I quote tweeted, blah, blah, blah. He wouldn't even know what I was talking about. But he knows that, like, Brie Larson is a bitch. You know, he doesn't know why. He just knows. And the reason he knows this is because it all funnels out of here. It all funnels out of the social media among all these blue checks who are addicted to Twitter. And it gets out into the news cycle and it gets out into the culture. So even though it's a small percentage of the populace, it is incredibly influential.
So remember Gladiator, remember the Colosseums, and they have those fights and everyone would cheer them on. There's a tiger and Russell Crowe and all that good stuff. So how did that stop?
Jesus. No, I'm just kidding. Well, kind of, actually. But how did it stop?
Yeah, what? Like, why are we not still doing, like, I mean, other than Twitter, but, like, why is that still not a thing?
I don't know that we ever stopped. I think we just changed how the Colosseum works. This is the Colosseum.
No, it is, but obviously there was there's a big chasm before this was developed between Colosseum.
And yeah, you had a disintegration into the medieval, you know, basically like a time of no history where people just like devolved into base kind of culture.
Yeah, well, they didn't need the Colosseum. They were just cutting each other's heads off. And
so that, if you look at cycles, is that what I mean? This cannot go on in this particular format and way forever. So, or maybe it can, but it seems to me there's got to be some logical counterbalance or
I think it's not going to be up to Gen X or millennials, really. Like I see, you know, people like my daughter who's going to be 11 this summer. Like her attitude, I mean, thankfully her dad and stepmom are the, you know, sober kinds of minds who have, you know, their 12, almost 11 and 5-year-old daughters completely offline, other than, you know, Skype with, you know, my daughter with me and a couple of their friends, but very offline. But I think that their generation is not going to be, after watching, I mean, I think that even my 11-year-old daughter looking at me, you know, being on Twitter and seeing my kind of like, you know, basic immersion into it in her early childhood and then subsequent like exasperation and disgust with it later, that she and her fellow, you know, classmates and contemporaries are gonna either find a new way to do it, because like you said, like Twitter is not always gonna be around. Instagram is not always, these things are not, you know, each generation kind of finds their own, as far as we know, finds their own way to deal with these things. And we don't even know. I mean, my generation started out with chat rooms and then went on to MySpace and then went on to Facebook. And now we're on Twitter and Instagram, et cetera. You have no clue what, you know, the after millennial generation is going to be into, and whether or not they're going to accept these kinds of.
We have no clue how it's going to be done. But I promise you, the thousands of years of everybody bloodthirsty waiting to watch people murder each other is not going to suddenly end with this generation because of Twitter. Like, it's always been this way.
No, in some level, because you have the Victorian period, and before that you had the Regency period, and before that the Georgian period.
Right, and what always happens?
Western. Well, but you have and it goes into an extreme.
It goes right back out. It comes. Yeah, it turns right around and does the same thing again.
Well, but that's the thing that's the thing that like, you know, the kids that are, you know, our kids' age, Ben, have to be on kind of like because we are at a point where we are seeing women, especially after the Me Too movement, where everybody's saying, oh, we can't treat women like they're these, you know, wilting violets because, you know, we're basically putting women back into Victorian era. Well, what's the answer to that then? And we're
training them how to fight with knives.
All right, I've got a potential answer for you guys. You're probably not going to like this, but the potential answer of what happens is if you look at how ill prepared so many of these kids are to do anything and what complete wusses they are, the reality is probably in like 20 or 30 years, China overtakes us and we end up living under a China communist regime and they censor everything. So we won't even have access to Twitter.
Beautiful. I was about to say, I think this all ends. How does Twitter end? Totalitarian regime. Like, that's just, we got Republicans asking.
That's the answer to everything.
It all always ends up with a bunch of people getting beheaded. That's all I know.
Yeah.
It's only a question whether or not we behead each other in a coliseum or the government is cutting our heads off for us. And I think we go back and forth in cycles. And you know, even some of these great generations that didn't give into those instincts, it was like, if you'd asked my grandfather, it was like, well, why weren't you into this kind of stuff? Well, I was busy fighting Nazis in Europe. And when, you know, he was a kid, it was the Depression. So yeah, we didn't have much time to watch each other murder each other because we were starving and then we were killing people overseas. And then they had, then those kids turned into be the boomers and we know how that worked.
And now, now when these kids are grown up and asking, Grandpa, what did you do? I was kicking butt on Twitter.
No, I know.
That is
can't
what your grandkids are going to say. Then.
Yeah.
I know. I can't wait.
Ben, I owned so many libs.
I was owning the libs. Totally owning the libs. Damn Fredo cons.
Ray said something I didn't like. And
Jay, you're right behind him. I don't know why you're mocking him.
Yeah. So anyway. So the entire social media conversation, which was a great conversation, kind of took over the show. So we're gonna have to move to the news. And Carol, you can stick around for the news, right?
I'm going to.
All right.
Whether you like it or not.
Damn right.
So.
And here's the news with Andrea Ruth.
Yeah, so going back to kind of the whole like generational shift and differences, is the Page Six article. Bob Woodward in an interview gave an interview tip, and his advice is to shut the fuck up. Bob Woodward was honored in front of a room full of literary lions at the PEN America Gala on Tuesday, and the All the President's Men author shared tips on how to conduct top interviews. He recalled that he and Carl Bernstein knocked on the doors of 100 potential sources in person while covering Watergate, and he enlisted the same strategy when pinning a book on George W. Bush decades later. It turns out 8:17 p.m. on a Tuesday is the best time to visit a general, Woodward related. He recalled a visit to an unnamed five-star officer. He opened the door, looked at me, and said, "Are you still doing this shit?" Woodward remained poker-faced in front of the military man. "I have learned from CIA case officers the power of silence and how important it is to let the silence suck out the truth," he said. So his advice is for reporters is to shut up.
So is Jim Acosta reading this? Or
Well, I bought Bob Woodward's masterclass on journalism, and there's one of the things that he says. He's talking about, well, what is journalism? And he said, you know, for a lot of people, they think it's, you know, people gathered at the mayor's office or at the White House and a bunch of people shouting questions and, you know, trying to get answers from. And he goes, that's not journalism. I've played that clip, you know, and tagged like Jim Acosta several times because Acosta thinks, you know, he's perfectly, like Ben just said, the complete opposite of that. He doesn't shut up. Because he wants to make himself the news story.
Yeah, I mean, he's like one briefing away from bringing a sword and a shield with him to the White House because he believes he's this valiant warrior. And I think that when people cast themselves as the hero, even if what they were doing is heroic, it automatically diminishes it. You're not supposed to call yourself a hero. Other people are supposed to call you that. And they admire, I think, a lot of people in the history of journalism, and they want to be like them, and they think so highly of the things these people did before them that they, you know, believe they're picking up the sword or whatever. But you're not, you need to do what those guys did. They didn't act that way.
Do you think these people have any idea what journalism is? I mean, it seems to me the entire system of media has been at least bastardized for the second time in this podcast, but bastardized. You know, you've got the BuzzFeed model where you put out some sort of slick and ridiculous headline that may or may not even match the article that you had to, you know, pump out in 10 seconds that has spelling mistakes in it because you're getting paid by the article or by the click or whatever it is. I don't know that many of the people who proclaim that they are journalists have any idea what it means to be a journalist at all.
Maybe they would if they've gotten free college and could go to J school.
I think they actually all did go to J school, and that is part of the problem.
Well, there is this culture, of course, of getting news out first and fast, mm-hmm. not necessarily right. And you see, the thing is, if you see a Wire story come out, you can almost always find Reuters does something. So somebody from the Washington Post or the New York Times, any really kind of, you know, news organization will run a similar story that basically just takes quotes from the same sources and just repeats it over and over again. So it's really nothing. They're not actually getting on the phone and doing any reporting, or they may get on the phone and make one phone call or something, but basically they're cobbling stories from other sources and kind of putting it together, because if the person who quotes something is on the record, it doesn't matter. You could just say so-and-so told the New York Times we didn't do this.
Yeah. And so they try to make it exciting too, because of the ratings, and they want the attention and they want the big contracts. And it's another example of where Twitter fucks everything up, because they can go on, you know, Brian Stelter can be like, well, people are saying, well, who? The people in my verified tab on Twitter. I mean, like, it just a bunch of anonymous people or people he knows are saying it. He can frame the entire conversation that way, knowing it's going to piss off whoever he's talking to. And then hopefully he gets an awesome clip of them fighting that gets posted on Mediaite later. And none of it has anything to do with whether or not there was a story.
Well, and there's also just this need to fill the 24-hour news cycle. And between, you know, 24-hour cable television and now social media, the fact that there always has to be something quote-unquote important, which is never important, out there. I mean, if you think about the journalists from yesteryear, you know, they had a paper that came out once a day, or they had an evening newscast that came out, you know, for an hour every night, and that was it. And they could actually be thoughtful and be very selective about, you know, what it was that they were talking about. They could spend time doing these investigations, and, you know, you would kind of hear stuff that was curated. And, you know, certainly there's a benefit to having less curation and less influence, but the flip side of it is that we just have a fire hose now, and that there's just a whole bunch of nothingness coming out that everybody thinks is super important for 5 seconds, and then we're all completely exhausted.
Right. Well, the news cycle moves so freaking fast these days, and people say that it's Trump that moves it that fast. This is the result of decades of, because when was it, like 1992 or 1991 when CNN launched? And then Fox News came in the 90s, and then MSNBC, and now they're all competing with each other. Of course the news cycle is going to start moving faster. They're
Social just lit a fire under that, right? I mean, that you had that, but there was no place for people to, like, opine on that, right? I mean, you could, you know, somebody could talk to, like, their family at dinner or something, or their buddies down at the VA or whatever. But, you know, now you've got the whole mob opining on this stuff 24 hours a day, 365 days a year.
God, we really are fucked, aren't we?
It's pretty bad.
But there's also where we see some of the best reporting, and this shows the strength of local reporting. So look at the Jeffrey Epstein case, it was the Miami Herald. If you look at the North Carolina fraud, it was the Charlotte, I think, the News and Observer. And
Scott Israel.
Yeah, you can go back to the Boston Globe uncovering the pedophile scandal. And even the paper that I worked for, the Dallas Morning News, did a Pain and Profit series that was devastating to a lot of people in Texas. But that is also where there's so much strength in that local reporting, because you do have these dogged reporters that go out there. And, you know, investigative reporting a lot of times is not exciting. You know, it's not this kind of, like, you're chasing stuff down and, you know, you have people with guns. You're digging through records. You're looking at microfiche and you're looking, you know,
producing an episode of 2020 is very cost intensive. And that the reason why, you know, places like PBS had Sesame Street could run things like Charlie Rose was because the Sesame Street brand brought in a lot of revenue. And same thing for ABC, NBC, CBS. They're kind of, you know, 60 minutes 2020 style, you know, shows don't bring in as much, you know, they cost a lot, But the other shows that they run throughout the week, like The Voice or, you know, American Idol, things like that, that's why you get those kinds of shows. They pay for the other shows.
Right, but the unfortunate thing is with local newspapers, you don't have that subsidization, so there is no money-making operation. Well,
and
operation also,
let's
there.
Not forget that it's boring to people. And we were talking about the Coliseum. I mean, that's, you know, they put on The Real World back in the early 90s, which is like the launch of reality television, that they probably thought people would just be interested to watch how the people interact, but really what everybody liked were the fights. And then eventually it all became about fights and all of reality television, all the tension and all the backstabbing and everything else. And now we've got like a reality television president, and all of the news people are the other combatants, and they're all just playing the game. They know that's what people want. They want to see the fight. They want people fighting.
And the sad reality is, I mean, there's so many people who are so tuned into national politics when truly the local politics mm-hmm. impacts your life more. Mm-hmm. And I think as the government has gotten more control and people have stepped out of their communities and they've substituted politics for religion and, you know, all of these sort of bad shifts that have happened that have moved us more towards this central national focused you know, being, unfortunately, you know, that really has come at the expense of these local reporters. And unfortunately, a lot of these local papers are going out of business.
Right.
And Jay and I had a conversation this morning in our living room about how, why do, you know, people outside of Alabama care a whit about what's happening inside Alabama, that the idea of a state having some level of sovereignty outside of what the federal government claims as its purview in the, you know, the Constitution and the, you know, Bill of Rights, that why do we want the states to be this homogeneous group of 50 states? And we're getting to that point where people from California think that people in Alabama must vote for the values that they have rather than the values that Alabamans have.
Well, right. Yeah. Well, and meanwhile,
so many avenues.
People believe that we live in a democracy. I mean, if you go out, I mean, people are so ill-informed that, you know, if you go and you read about any issue online, people say, well, we live in a democracy. We live in a democracy. It's like, no, honey, we don't live in a democracy. Where did you hear that?
Right. And the absurdity, real quick, Ben, the absurdity of the, what Andrea's talking about, Californians talking about Alabama, is the California Governor Gavin Newsom saying he's forming a task force to find solutions for the homeless problem in California, as if this just sprung up in the last year. I mean, that's what's going to do it.
For those people who know local politics, Gavin Newsom was the mayor of San Francisco.
Right.
Mm-hmm. He didn't just become governor.
And the lieutenant governor.
The mayor of San Francisco, which is the epicenter of the homeless problem and the people who are pooing and leaving their needles on the sidewalk.
You know, another aspect of this that I think is a problem with the way that the news operates, the national news, is when over the last decade or so, probably a little longer actually, you had these, it used to be that the media covered the political class. I mean, sure, they all drank cocktails together, but it was one group covering another group. And at some point, you know, you had places like Media Matters come out. These political, I mean, they're political organizations. They have an agenda. They have financing from, you know, activist billionaires, and they present it as objective news. Everyone knows it's not, but you can ask anybody who's come out of CNN. Media Matters is where they get a lot of their stuff. It's where MSNBC gets a lot of their stuff. A lot of these politically funded organizations that have a specific tribal agenda are taking the place of the New York Times, which used to be like what everybody read in the morning. And while they were biased, at the very least, they weren't literally funded by political activist groups. And I think that messes with the whole news cycle as well. There's these blurred lines. I see people on Facebook, the ones that we were talking about earlier, who don't, because these people who aren't on Twitter, they are on Facebook. And they're sharing stuff from a lot of these, you know, from the left or the right. If it's presented in a way to look like objective news, they just treat it like it is, and they'll just share it.
And Media Matters skates under the radar as a 501c3 by claiming that they're a quote-unquote educational organization instead of basically a water carrier for Democrats.
But I think it also goes into the kind of thing where, you know, people will point out, like, Ben Bradley was good friends with John Kennedy and things like that, and you get into those kinds of things, but the argument is moot when you're talking about 1960s and 50s media newspapers, where the Washington Post was a very localized newspaper. It was not a national, you know, very few people outside of Washington got, Washington, D.C., got that newspaper. Now you do have, since 1982, or when did CNN first come online? Early 80s?
It was, all I know is they made it big because of the Gulf War. I don't know when they were
founded. Yeah, I mean, but since then, you do have, like, there is a difference between, you know, Ben Bradley being friends with John Kennedy and, say, you know, Joe Scarborough being and Mika Brzezinski being in Donald Trump's hotel room before the debate on MSNBC in 2016, like, right. Or 2015. Like,
yeah, you talk about the difference between close friendships and relationships. Of course, yeah. These people would have relationships, but it goes beyond relationships at some point and becomes working together.
Mm-hmm. It's funny listening to all you guys. This is so interesting to me because obviously I spend a lot of time, you know, I'm in the media. I spend a lot of time on Twitter chatting with you guys and folks like yourselves about this stuff. In my real life, like when I talk to my family and I talk to my friends, none of these people have any idea about any of these things we're talking about.
Yeah.
Not, I mean, like literally none. Like if they're on Facebook, they're sharing pictures of their kids' graduation and of, you know, cats and whatever. And when I talk about these things, people look at me like I'm an alien. And that's the interesting dichotomy that's going on here.
But don't you think that those same people, you know, I can't speak specifically about your family. My mom just sends me stuff. Is this true? You know, that kind of stuff.
that is true. We have a lot of like, hey, I think I heard something about this. What do you know about this? Or the worst is I've got a 13-year-old little cousin who hears stuff at school. Some of it from his teachers, and then comes and asks me, like, what's going on with this? And I'm like, oh, man, do I really have to explain?
Yeah, like, I feel like they don't, like, any of my neighbors or any of my friends, or my dad's not even, he's not on anything. He's not on anything. But he will watch the news. And I think that the issue is they don't know why they know the results of what gets figured out because of all the things we're talking about. But they do know the results. You know, Trump is racist. You know, let's just put aside like any personal opinions on that question and just say, if that's something that was born in this sphere that we all operate in, it certainly made its way out to the people in my neighborhood who aren't even on social media. You know, it starts here, and certainly the sphere we're talking about is limited to a smaller percentage of the country. I just still think it gets out to them.
But do they know who Michael Avenatti is? Because, like, my family, if I said Michael Avenatti, they'd be like, oh, does he have an Italian
restaurant? I would say they would know that there was something about a prostitute. That would be about what they would know.
Speaking of Michael Avenatti, he was just charged with defrauding Stormy Daniels.
Yes, that's crazy. He seems like such an upstanding moral.
So I had a third story, but I will only go into the second story. I just want to get to this because, Jay, for years you have said, and I'm sure that it's been said on Twitter for a decade or more, that you could never make another All in the Family. You could never make another Good Times. You could never make another the Jeffersons. But right now, as we record this podcast, the fearless Jimmy Kimmel is producing a live performance of a recreation of All in the Family, starring Woody Harrelson as Archie Bunker, Marissa Tomei as Edith Bunker, Jamie Foxx as George Jefferson, and Wanda Sykes as Louise Jefferson. And it seems to be going swell. And would you not know that Jimmy Kimmel had this to say about it? Norman Lear, who created All in the Family, did so much for freedom of speech and inclusivity, we'd be way behind without him. Jay, would you have anything to say about your favorite late night host, Jimmy Kimmel?
this is going to be, if whatever they're doing is going to be a complete joke. It will, you know, when I always said they could never make it today, I mean, they could never make it in the same way that they did it back then, using the same scripts. It just wouldn't happen. You guys, some of you are old enough to remember when what was the
no,
show? Yeah, you are. Just don't think you're young, Ben. You're an old man, too. Somebody got in trouble on the show or somebody called, she referred to her cleaning lady as a tamale or something like that. She said she's a tamale. And this is back in the 1990s, and people freaked out. And it wasn't even that bad. It wasn't, the cleaning woman wasn't even Mexican or something like that, but she still called her that or something. And it was like, it was this ridiculous outrage kind of thing. If there are clips, you guys can continue to talk about this because I'm going to search for something. And we'll see if that's something that would actually get past the social justice iron wall today.
It seems like if Jimmy Kimmel and Woody Harrelson and these other people are going to make a show based on that general premise, it's going to be to recast the narratives. Because, you know, back then, I think they were trying to show that everybody comes from different backgrounds, different understandings of the world, different cultures, but that, you know, deep down we can get along and there's good in all of us and there's wisdom to be had from all of us. Well, they can't allow that now. If there's a character on the show who represents somebody who thinks the way that some, like a racist did in the 70s, they're not going to be like, oh, we found the wisdom in him. They're going to be like, he needs to be in a death camp. I mean, they're not going to present it the same way.
No, you're 100% right, Pat. I mean, there's sort of two different levels. There's the virtue signaling celebrity level where they're never going to allow people to do that. And then there's the squeaky wheel vocal minority that, you know, is going to be outraged and nobody has the cojones to come up and say, be quiet, this is what we're doing, stop being such little babies. Because people just did that. People just told people to stop being such little babies. Eventually people would stop being babies, but nobody has the fortitude to do that.
I still don't know how Jimmy Kimmel has the woke credentials after he had a show that had women jumping on trampolines at the end of every episode.
Right.
Exactly.
And there was the one done on the street asking if it was Jimmy Kimmel or like a sausage or something like that in his pants that was there.
Right. Now, so Jimmy, I'm reading from the Variety article where I found this, and Jimmy Kimmel says, so some of the jokes are going to be shocking to you, but now you can have dragons birding naked women at the stakes. And I think that goes exactly to what, you know, Carol was saying, is that you can have horrifying imagery on screen, but you can't even have, you know, I think last week that Family Guy has said that they're going to back off on doing so many gay jokes. You can't have certain verbiage, but you can have plenty of imagery in your.
I don't trust this all of a sudden. I feel like this is like a big experiment or something. His words sound pretty carefully selected there.
Well, Jimmy Kimmel, can we just run down the list? Jimmy Kimmel has been in blackface. Mm-hmm. He had a show with women jumping on trampolines called The Man Show. He had people feeling his banana in his pocket to see if they were happy to see him. I mean, he's literally committed every faux pas, but because he's got the right letter next to his name and he is an ally, he gets to get away with it.
As long as you cry about healthcare, or cry about a lion that's getting killed.
So there is an episode. I'm just going to read this because I can't find a clip. There was an episode, and Andrew knows this. I've told her about this one before. It was an episode of the Jeffersons. It was All in the Family. The Jeffersons were on, and Lionel was talking about this is Louise and George Jefferson's son, Lionel, was thinking of dropping out of college. And so Louise says, and you know what happens to blacks with no education and looking for a job. They are last on the list. George Jefferson says, no, they ain't. The Puerto Ricans are last. And Archie says, he's right, Louise. The Puerto Ricans are last. Only they don't know it because they can't read the list.
That's not going to be in this new version.
No, absolutely not. It won't even come close to being in that version. Now, if you watch the show, it gives away. What it does is it reflects poorly on Archie and George, who are ignorant about these types of things. It has nothing to do with what they're saying is true, but that's how people perceive it, and so that's why they would freak out. How dare you say something so outrageous about Puerto Rico? Well, because that's the person that they are. It's a show. It is not something that the writers really believe.
This is what kills me, because people were doing this about Game of Thrones. They were like, look how they treat women. Look at how they treat minorities. I'm like, okay, it's a medieval world ruled by white men. Why are you expecting them to all of a sudden not be that? They're not saying it's good. They're saying it's bad. They had a couple of rapes in Game of Thrones, and people were like, you're glorifying it. No, that's like, we couldn't wait to watch that guy die. It's not endorsement to be writing these stories. It's reflective. You're reflecting what you know is still out there.
Right. That's why I love Jerry Seinfeld saying he would never apologize for telling a joke, because he said, it's a joke. It's not real. Yeah. I can't apologize for something that's not real.
But go ahead.
I was going to say, it's also reflective of why we have the mob. I mean, the fact of the matter is that joking and laughter is a coping mechanism, and it's the way that we deal with our feelings and all of the silly, absurd things that are around with us. It's a release. And the fact that people don't feel like they are able to have these normal releases, which are required, is why they blow up over absolutely every stupid, moronic thing.
I think, though, that we could be in for a major correction when it comes to the way people are being silenced in this sense.
I don't know. Because so look at a guy, that's a good segue. That? What I was going to say, it's a good segue. Make sure you can, if you go to Washington Examiner, Robbie Suave, who's editor at Reason, wrote a great piece in this week's issue of the Washington Examiner magazine, basically talking about, disagreeing with you, Ben, that the political correctness crowd is going to be here for a long time, and it may get worse before it gets
well,
better.
Well, this is what I was going to say, though, is, you know, you've got, like, for instance, take comedy, which I think is probably one of the first walls that is collapsing. And you got Louis C.K. And it has nothing to do with what Louis C.K. did or whether or not it was excusable or any of that. The point is, it was decided that he should be gone. He's shunned. But he had already made millions of dollars. And then after he was quiet for long enough, he came back out. And now his comedy is even more subversive than it was before, because he's got nothing to lose. Like, what are they going to take from him? And I think that some comedians are going to, like, this is going to happen again. Kevin Hart kind of had the same situation. I think at some point, these comedians who are watching what they say because they're worried about the woke brigades coming to them, at some point, they're going to be like, dude, I want to be more like those guys who have nothing to lose. Because it right now, it's they're out saying the things that they want to say, and they're doing fine, because it turns out that when it comes to the free market, that's true of audiences too. People will still choose Louis C.K. People will still choose Kevin Hart. And if they see that happen enough times, then maybe the tide will start to turn.
That's the rub, Ben. That's the one place where we still have a challenge, is that we have a lot of guilt by association. And so if you like Louis C.K. or Kevin Hart and you go to see their show and you're tweeting about it, then you get the guilt by association. How dare you think that's funny? How dare you support that guy who did this? How dare you? And then you become the target, and you have something to lose, even though Kevin Hart or Louis C.K. or whoever doesn't have anything to lose. And I still think that that's an issue, and that holds back that sort of natural momentum from picking up too much.
Right. What you could also do is you could do what Jimmy Kimmel's other half on The Man Show has done, Adam Carolla. He basically says, he does say whatever the hell he wants to say, because he's not a terrestrial radio. He's not doing HBO. He's not doing any of these things. What does he say, Andrew? He's like a pirate.
He has a pirate ship.
Yeah,
and it kind of drives the point home, though, that Jimmy Kimmel's on national television getting attention constantly and is on all the places that Adam's not. So there's certainly a career cost for him doing whatever he wants.
Oh, yeah, but he's still a millionaire. You know, I mean, that's the whole thing. Is he a multi-millionaire? No, but he's doing what he loves to do. He's racing cars. He does a podcast. And he makes millions of dollars a year. I mean, has he not been in the spotlight the way Jimmy Kimmel has? Sure. I think there's obviously some revenue issues there. Carolla didn't get a comedy special on Netflix when they give those out like candy to even the dumbest of comedians and the worst of comedians. He didn't get one, but he went, instead of bitching about it, saying that they were, like, you know, holding him back or something, he went and did it on his own. He released it anyway.
Yeah, but there are some people that they take the Adam Carolla route. And these are the people that I really keep an eye on. They have somehow survived no matter what. Joe Rogan, South Park creators, like, they can do whatever they want. And they say the kind of shit that you hear people even on the right say, or stuff that you would assume would get you kicked out of the Hollywood. But South Park was so good at it that nobody wanted to go after them, because they knew that the mockery would destroy them.
To me, first of all, they are my heroes. Like, South Park is my everything. And the fact that they have been able to really avoid any sort of major scrutiny for this long is just, it boggles my mind every single day.
I still remember when they appeared on the Dennis Miller Show. Remember, Dennis Miller was on HBO, and the South Park movie had just come out. and Dennis was laughing. He was cracking up because of the picture. Remember when Satan was in bed with Saddam Hussein? Mm-hmm. You know whose picture was on the wall behind them?
Skeet, like George Bush or
no,
something?
No, Skeet Ulrich. And Dennis was like, was that Skeet Ulrich on the back? You know, he laughs. It was, they laughed at it for like 2 or 3 minutes. It's Skeet Ulrich on the wall. And, you know, but that was the kind of humor that was just totally well, they, but
they,
you know,
the thing is, that it went way beyond the show. I mean, like, my favorite moment of them was when they were on the, they got a Peabody Award, and they get up on stage to accept their Peabody Award, and Trey Parker starts talking, and he says, you know, you don't always get the opportunity to have your art recognized by your esteemed colleagues. And people started laughing, and he goes, what the fuck are you laughing at? And I just loved that. And then they just made jokes about Battlestar Galactica and left. And it almost seemed like, why does nobody mess with them? Not only because their satire is so deadly, but also because it's not going to do anything.
Right.
They don't care, and they're willing to say, stop being pussies, we don't care. They're willing to say it. Not enough people are willing to say it.
Well, that's the other thing, too, is like how many of these comedians are so worried that they're not going to get that Netflix special, or they're not going to get an HBO show, or they're not, you know, I think they go from making low six, seven figures to making, you know, eight figures, and suddenly it's like wow, you know, now I have all the money to do this, and I do this, and I don't want to ruin that. If their motivation is financial or what, but it would seem that would certainly be part of it. I mean, Louis C.K. is no longer going to be doing jokes about having to shit in the on the toilet with his foot in the tub,
well,
like he used to.
Have you heard some of his jokes? His new ones.
No, I'm saying talking about being.
The first joke he said when he came out on stage was I like to masturbate in front of people.
Right.
Like,
well, I'm saying he's not going to be doing any more like I don't have any money jokes kind of thing.
Oh, right, right.
Right. That's all I meant about that.
Well, you know, the I have empathy for these guys though. I mean, I think, you know, for people who are sort of submitting to the will of the woke brigades because they have dreams that have nothing to do with activism. And they're just like, you know, whatever, I'm paying my dues, I'm doing what I'm told, I just want the Netflix special because I want to get to that next level. Yeah. And I think maybe they tell themselves, you know, once I have accumulated enough capital, enough power, where I can say what I want, I will. But that isn't generally how it works. Like, once you get to that level, now you don't want to lose it.
Right.
And so I have empathy for them. It's got to be scary if you're somebody who sees the stuff that's happening, doesn't like it, but also knows that you have to come out and condemn Dave Chappelle for making a transgender joke, or everybody's going to tell you that you're the next Taylor Swift.
Which was like one of the funniest parts of that special.
Well, that's what always gets me, is whenever those kinds of jokes happen, like Bill Burr, whenever those kinds of jokes, there's nobody in the audience not laughing. Nobody.
Yeah.
Like they, every single time. And I'm just like, you guys all know. You all know exactly what he's talking about. You know exactly what he has an issue with. And can we just stop pretending?
Yeah, and by the way, Dave Chappelle's show is another one where big question mark on whether you can make it today. And, you know, one of the funniest shows of all time.
Easily.
And I think that there would be a lot of sanitizing things. Now, again, maybe he's untouchable because he's got the right intersectionality or whatever. But it just kind of depends on the day.
Yeah,
it depends on the mob. It depends how they're feeling. They like you. Are you in? Did you do a good thing? Whatever. Who knows?
Right. They clearly will turn on anyone. I mean, on anyone.
Well, I mean, it's part of the reason why Jerry Seinfeld said he was going to stop doing comedy shows at college campuses. He goes, I'm just tired of, you know, constantly being harangued because I tell jokes.
Yeah. You know, I think even ridiculous. Bill Maher is definitely getting sick of this.
I mean, think about when Jerry Seinfeld is too hardcore for you. Like, you've really lost the plot when you can't sit through a Jerry Seinfeld routine. I mean, Jerry Seinfeld is known. He is the clean comic. He doesn't do anything dirty. He is like, you know, like as American as apple pies.
I know. And yet I'm waiting for the Slate article. We need to discuss the problem of Jerry Seinfeld.
Yeah. And who, you know, who else it would be? It'll be Jim Gaffigan. It'll be another one because when he sits there and he talks about, you know, like he was talking about, I was watching before my daughter and there's a thing where he said, you know, I help as much as I can. I do diapers. He goes, I don't change them. I just say to my wife, you need to do this diaper. You need to do a diaper. You know, he makes these jokes about his wife and it's like, it's funny. It's probably not even, again, it's jokes. I mean, it's probably not true, likely not true, but it doesn't matter. It's the words he's saying are harmful.
So I wonder, do these people like Richard Pryor and George Carlin?
Or Red Fox?
Oh, my God. Could you imagine? George Carlin is turning over in his grave. But, you know, I think that those people are too fringe. Like, Bill Burr is one of my favorite. I listen to the Monday Morning podcast twice a week all the time. And I just think that he's not, I mean, even though he's huge, he's not quote unquote mainstream. And I don't think he's somebody that's going to draw the attention of somebody who's woke. I just don't think that there's like their spheres of influence ever intersect. And that's probably why he gets to say some of the things that he gets to say. Whereas, you know, Kevin Hart makes some comment on Twitter and gets dragged apart because he's so mainstream.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Like, there's not going to be a time where Bill Burr is invited to host the Oscars. Like, it's not going to happen. So it's not going to be
unfortunate for all of us.
But I mean, Bill Burr, even so, it depends on whose audience is. Like, if he goes on Conan cracks up. If he goes on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon cracks up. And Andrea and I watched him one time when he was with
Colbert.
And Colbert, like, for some reason, like, you know, the host wasn't turned towards the audience. He was turned his back basically to the audience and was just kind of looking at Burr. And like, he would smile when Burr was telling these jokes, but he wouldn't laugh. And you could tell, you could tell Burr was a little uncomfortable. Like, what is going on here? Why is this guy doing this? You know?
You know, I think Bill Burr's even said that in a lot of ways he couldn't make it if he was just now starting. Like, he was kind of grandfathered in, right?
Oh yeah, well he did a lot on. You find him in Chappelle Show bits when he had hair.
Probably
when you had hair, man.
The dice game. One of the announcers in the dice game.
Think about that. You know, you were just saying that maybe even Chappelle Show. Remember the racial draft when Tiger Woods got accepted to be full black and he said, and goodbye fried rice, hello fried chicken?
Yes.
is there any way that joke would work today?
No.
Well, I'm also not going to say the name of the family, but there was a family skit, which you can look up, and I'm not getting flipped out on that one. But you think that one's going to fly? I mean, there's so many.
Or the black Klansman. I mean, like, there's just, yeah.
I mean,
what really disappointed me about Chappelle when Chappelle did his first like Netflix special, and it was so like kind of refreshing, groundbreaking, and then he did the second half of it and it was so pandering and it was just painful, and you just could not, it just basically like almost took back everything that he said in the first one, where he was basically like making, he basically walked you through 2 decades of his opinion changing on OJ.
Right, you know. Right. Okay, so we're at 100
Party pooper. Hour.
I know, I'm sorry, but before we go, we're gonna listen to a classic little clip here from the Dave Chappelle Show.
Wait for it.
We gotta wait for the ads. What is that? All right, getting past the Godzilla. Here we go.
What will it be, guys? I'll have a Scotch on the rocks. I'll have a Samuel Adams. I'll have a Samuel Jackson. You know something? I'll have a Samuel Jackson too.
Me three.
3 Samuel Jacksons coming right up.
Good motherfucking choice. Samuel Jackson. Named painstakingly by me. Samuel L. Jackson. It'll get you drunk. You'll be fucking fat girls in no time. You might even fight a nigga or two. Bitch. How's it taste, motherfucker?
Can you stop yelling at me, please?
No, I can't stop yelling, because that's how I talk. You ain't never seen my movies. Juice, that was a good one. Deep Blue Sea, they ate me. A fucking shark ate me. Crank, bitch. Jurassic Park. Samuel Jackson, it's my beer. Yes, they deserve to die, and I don't think they're in hell.
It's a hell of a drug, man.
Yeah. Well, Carol Roth, thank you so much for being on. This was such a fun conversation.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it, and sorry, like, I'm like a squirrel. I took you all over place.
You know, these are some of the shows that our audience loves.
I'm diagnosed ADHD, so
yes, so we don't talk about it.
I'm sure I helped.
But Carol, where can everybody find you?
Yeah, so a couple things. Check out my Future File Legacy Planning System at futurefile.com on Twitter, since we've all established that's where we spend all of our time, at Carol J.S. Roth. And then if you enjoyed this conversation, check out my podcast, The Roth Effect, which you can find wherever fine podcasts are downloaded.
Yeah, and if you really, one of my favorite episodes, and I've listened to several, is the one you did with Steve Forbes. So if anybody wants to, if you want to hear some free market talk about the economy and finance, go and listen to that episode. It's absolutely terrific. So definitely endorse. Ben, where can everyone find you?
Well, you can find me on the aforementioned Twitter, where I will be saying things that will eventually get me banned and shunned from society.
Where can we find you when you get banned, Ben?
You can find me huddled
in Andrea and Jay's den.
No, I'll be hanging out with Milo Yiannopoulos.
Paul Joseph Watson.
What was that island in the Rudolph,
Misfit Toys. Yes.
Yeah, but that's at Ben Howe. And then my book's coming out in August, The Immoral Majority, about evangelicals embracing political power over their own.
Yeah, and get out to the thing. What Ben's talking about is with his book is you want to go out to tell your friends to sign up for this podcast, get it downloaded, because we are going to give away some signed copies, right, Ben?
Oh, of course.
Okay. Woo-hoo. Sorry. So there you go. Andrea, where can everybody find you?
On Twitter, Andrea and Ruth, as long as you're nice and willing to engage in a reasonable and like not freak out kind of way lately. I just can't handle it anymore. You can sign up for the ARC Digital newsletter. I curate that once a week and try to come up with fun new greetings in different languages and different plays on words each week as best I can. But, you know, it's just a newsletter. But it's the best newsletter other than yours, Jay, which is the Monday Notice. And then you can find me... Where else am I? Oh, the Right Side Podcast with Kimberly Ross. We're coming back on first weekend of June. We took pretty much the entire month of May off for travel and Mother's Day and all kinds of things. So,
how have you been on Twitter this long and you don't know that your request that people be nice to you just guaranteed that you will get people coming after you to be mean?
Well, you know what? You have to put good vibes. I grew up enough on the West Coast that I know that you just have to put good vibes out there, and then they're supposed to come back to you.
We need to have a discussion about world history.
I would say, Andrea, that the trolls are actually pretty fun if you embrace them. The one that kills me are the dumb people. Like, I'll take a good troll who's intentional and knows what they're doing any day over somebody who's just really daft.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would take the, I assume you know that. That like I prefer that rather than the like legitimate, like, you know, be my researcher for me.
No, the worst are that you're smarter than that. You're better.
You're better than that, Ben. No, I'm not.
Yeah, then they say like some non-fact and go, but you knew that. I'll wait.
Yeah, I'll wait.
You want to vote for Trump. Your heart is telling you that and you know it.
I'm guilty of using the I'll wait thing just because I think it's funny. Because I literally like rarely look at my notifications. And so it's like, I will wait, but I'm not going to wait like, you know, doing my life.
I'm almost to the point where I will block people for saying I'll wait or full stop. And that doesn't even mean... They don't even have to be saying it to me. If I see somebody go, full stop, fuck you.
I'm going to actually tweet that to you, Ben.
Yeah, I know, right?
I'll wait, full stop.
I'll wait, full stop.
Yeah, you're better than this, full stop.
Response back.
You're better than this, full stop. Prove it to me. I'll wait. All right, I'm Jay Caruso. You can find me on Twitter at Jay Caruso. Also at the Washington Examiner, I have the cover story for this week's issue. It is the final Rolling Thunder run on Memorial Day here in Washington, D.C. It's going to be a much more localized event next year, so there's going to be hundreds of thousands of motorcyclists here for the final time, and I wrote about that story, and the cover really looks great. It's a bunch of bikers riding off into the sunset. You can also find me, go to my Twitter, and you can find my link to the my newsletter, the Monday Notice.
But be nice to him.
Yeah, be nice to me. Please be nice to me.
Full stop.
And full stop. But yeah, you can be mean to me on Twitter because I'm going to be mean right back because fuck you. All right. So anyway, yeah. And anyway, once again, thank you, Carol Roth. Thanks, Ben. Thanks, Andrea. That is going to do it for this edition of the Fifth Estate. We will see you next time.